This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. This week, Governor J.B. Pritzker is scheduled to make his annual budget presentation to the Illinois General Assembly. We'll have more detailed coverage of that on Wednesday, but I mention that because it's relevant to our next topic of conversation today, which has to do with what's become known as Illinois' two-year budget impasse. I was a State House reporter during that time, and to be honest with you, I always hated that term, impasse, because it implied that Democrats and Republicans simply could not agree on how to raise and spend money. But in fact, the problem was much deeper than that. Then Governor Bruce Rauner, a Republican, wanted to transform state government. His animating idea was that labor unions had way too much power, whether AFSCME and SEIU, which represent a lot of state workers, or the Illinois Education Association and the Illinois Federation of Teachers. He wanted to break their power over how state and local governments spend money in Illinois. And before he even campaigned for office, he talked about using social justice spending in Illinois as a means to achieve his end. He stopped talking like that when he campaigned for governor, but he did make good on that approach when he took office in 2015. Democrats refused to go along, hence the impasse. Illinois went 2 years without a budget. Thanks to the order of a county judge in the Metro East part of the state, state employees got paid. But agencies with whom Illinois contracts for social services, like preventing violence, addressing trauma in communities, those groups did not get paid. Many had to cut programs and staff as a result. And to be clear, the Democrats are not blameless either. They had majorities in the House and the Senate. They could have passed a budget and dared Rauner to veto it. They didn't want to go that far out on a limb. And all that, in turn, seems to have been a big factor in a spike in homicides in Chicago. That's a long windup to get to that point, which is the subject of a recent report and what we'll be talking about for the rest of the program today. Marianne Mason is a sociologist and associate professor of emergency medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She's the first author on the report I mentioned. Marianne, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Andrea Durbin, the CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. It's an organization that represents scores of groups that work to prevent violence and improve the lives of young Illinoisans. Durbin was one of the leaders of the legal fight to get social service agencies paid during the impasse. Andrea, thank you for joining us today as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Marianne Mason, I want to begin with you. What inspired you to try and make this connection? What was the chicken or egg in this report? Was it looking at the homicides and trying to figure out what was behind the spike, or was it trying to, you know, weigh the effects of the impasse?
For myself and our author team, it was looking at the homicides. I am the principal investigator for something called the Illinois Violent Death Reporting System, which tracks violent deaths in Illinois. And one of the things we observed was a rapid escalation in homicides during 2016. And we really wanted to better understand what was behind the rapid increase and then the equally rapid decrease that happened in the later half of 2017.
And big picture finding is that, we don't have to tease it too much more, is that the budget impasse was a huge factor in that, right?
The budget impasse is clearly associated in a temporal way, in a time frame way, with the rapid rise and decrease in homicides.
And how do you make that calculation? How is that determined?
That's using a statistical method called U-chart analysis. It's probably too technical not of great interest.
I'm regretting my question already.
Basically, we're able to look at the youth homicide rates for a period of time before and after the budget impasse and able to detect the shift in statistically significant numbers. So we charted a 77% increase that coincided with the lack of a state budget.
Okay. And Andrew, we have to take a break, unfortunately, in about a minute, but maybe you can just remind us, what were organizations that serve young people facing in 2015, 2016, this time period we're talking about?
Well, thanks, Brian. What I would say is, like, overnight, people had contracts to do this work, and there was no legal mechanism to pay them. And there was a lot of confusion. And so folks didn't know initially what to do. In the past, when we had, you know, budget standoffs between the governor and the General Assembly, they'd only lasted a few weeks, and everybody thought, oh, this will be resolved. So initially, it didn't change service delivery on the ground immediately. But as time went on, providers had to struggle more and more to make payroll, to keep their doors open. And so without a great deal of like collective planning, people were being laid off, hours of service were being cut back. And we saw that, you know, services were being withdrawn. Ultimately, I think the United Way thought that over 1 million people lost access to service during this time.
Wow. All right. We're going to continue this conversation. We're talking about a new report that posits a connection between the state budget impasse and a spike in homicides, particularly among young people in the year 2016. We're speaking with one of the co-authors of that report, Marianne Mason, and Andrea Durbin with the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about a new report that found a statistically significant shift in homicides among young people in the year 2016. It was at a lower level in 2015. It shot up in 2016 and dropped back down by mid-2017. And it looked at a number of factors, trying to figure out what was behind that. And the best link that they, maybe I want to be careful how I phrase this, the report is specific in saying they seem to have found a correlation in the state budget impasse. You'll recall that was 2 years when Republican Governor Bruce Rauner and the Democratic majorities in the Illinois General Assembly were at loggerheads. Governor Rauner wanted the Democrats to weaken labor unions that represent government employees, state and local government employees, and Democrats did not want to go along with that, and neither would approve a budget in the absence of the other bending to their will. And 2 years, Illinois went without funding a lot of social service agencies. And we're speaking about that with one of the co-authors of the report, Marianne Mason, who is a sociologist and associate professor of emergency medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She's first author on that report. And we're also joined by Andrea Durbin, the CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth, which represents scores of groups that work to prevent violence and improve the lives of young Illinoisans. And she was one of the leaders in the legal fight to get social service agencies paid during the budget impasse. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. If you have a question for one of our guests or a comment on this topic, 800-222-9455. Or you can always tweet us at 21st Show. So, Marianne Mason, I want to ask you, one of the conclusions of the report has this phrase that state funding may be a potential protective factor against youth homicide. Can you talk, it's sort of clinical language, but in what form does that take as a protective factor? What does that mean?
So if you think about youth homicide or any homicide in general, there are identified risk factors and identified protective factors. Usually they're in contrast to one another. And so what we're concluding here, and I don't believe we're the only study to ever have reached this conclusion, there's several other studies out there, that the provision of services funded by the state can actually contribute to protective factors for youth, which are things like pro-social engagement opportunities, so recreational opportunities, targeted violence prevention opportunities, things like street outreach and intervention, mental health services, and after-school programming and arts and other recreational things. Those are all protective factors, which are in part or in some cases wholly funded by the state's budget.
Andrea, your organization works with a number of other groups that are trying to implement these protective factors. What does that look like? What form do those organizations take? What services do they provide?
Well, as Dr. Mason mentioned, you know, things like after-school programs and violence prevention programs and things give young people an opportunity to engage, first of all, to be safe, you know, safe activities that aren't on the street, supervision, but also a lot of services kind of come couched within those programs. So social emotional learning, for example, linkages to services for trauma. You know, when young people experience trauma either directly or in a secondary way because of something that they witnessed or they saw that's happened in their neighborhood, you know, there's opportunities there for adults to intervene and to help young people process that. If you can't address trauma, it just festers and grows. And so within these services, you'll find that there's a lot of, you know, it's not just like, oh, here we are after school and we're going to do some fun activities and help you with your homework, but there's relationships building, there's social emotional learning, there's opportunities to address and respond to trauma and things like that. And when you take those away, and especially, I just can't emphasize this enough, when you take them away overnight without warning, no planning, it's just, they're just gone. You know, you leave people really stranded high and dry without resources and without services. And, you know, and I think what we're seeing is that some people and some communities paid a very, very high price for that.
And a factor you raise, and this is something we've talked about on the show before, I don't think it can be stated enough, though, is that the idea of the, how would you say, perpetrator and victim, there are blurred lines there, right? That yesterday's victim might very well become tomorrow's perpetrator in this cycle of violence.
Right, exactly. That trauma ripples, you know, and it has, you know, it's not just the individual person who suffered, but it's their family, obviously, their community, their colleagues, their fellow students. You know, it ripples out, and it's almost you know, waves that bounce off the wall and then they start coming back again, you know, like in a pool where you see the waves go out, but then they bounce and they come back again. And that's how I think about this kind of cycle of violence is, you know, where people, as you say, you know, you could be the victim one day and the perpetrator the next, because that's the sort of toxic environment that we're leaving people in. And without intervention, without help. I mean, the good news is trauma can be healed and there are things that people can do, but, you know, it can fester and it can grow and it can have these even intergenerational ripple effects.
And just to add to that, we know about 85% of homicide victims have had a prior victimization and have also perpetrated violence in the past. So we know that these things are overlapping for many people. And we also know that trauma and violence victimization is a risk factor for violence perpetuation. So we know these things are dangerous for people and communities, and in particular for people who are living in low resource communities where there aren't a lot of alternatives to government funded programs for people to get the help they need.
Marian Mason, can you talk about some of the other factors you considered and through your analysis decided were not correlated to the spike in homicides?
Mm-hmm. So just a reminder that this study is set in Chicago. So this is we looked at specifically Chicago-based issues as well as some more broader issues that we thought might impact things. So we looked at things like high profile legal intervention deaths, the kind of Michael Brown and Freddie Gray legal intervention deaths that were very disturbing to many. Those did not seem to have an impact on youth homicide. We also looked at something that has been used in other studies to explain this increase, which is the consent decree between the Chicago Police Department, which put a pause on stop and frisk procedures and policies. And the trouble with the explanation that says this increase is coincides with the pause on stop and frisk is that that remained in effect through, 2018, and we saw a rapid decline in youth homicide in 2017. So how could the stop and frisk pause actually be the cause of this, since it wasn't lifted or changed in any way?
Interesting. So stop and frisk, not a valid explanation for what was happening here.
No, I don't believe so, just because of the rapid decline and there was no change in stop and frisk. We also looked at things that were going on with Chicago public schools, school closures, and strikes and graduation rates and things like that, and didn't find any connections.
I can't remember the phrase you used, police intervention or something. Basically, you were talking about when police are shooting unarmed Black people, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah.
So, yeah, we call them legal interventions in the research world.
Legal intervention. Okay. I just wanted to make that point clear. And that is one thing you have often heard, and maybe this ties into other aspects of what you were researching. I think it was Mayor Emanuel who used the phrase that the police had, quote, gone fetal, right, in the wake of some of the protests that were happening around that time, that maybe mm-hmm. police weren't, you know, actively fighting crime as much as they could have for fear of, you know, getting in trouble, or because they were resentful, whatever factor it might be. Is that something you considered as well?
Yeah, we considered the impact of those high profile police killings, but the trouble with those as a factor is you would expect the police pullback, if indeed it happened to be, you know, immediate after a high profile event, and it doesn't line up with the change in homicides on her timeline.
Andrea, can you talk about, this spike happened in 2016, but there were people then who were presumably the siblings of the victims and perpetrators of violence at that time. They're getting older now. Do you still think we're feeling echoes of the budget impasse in the spike in violence we've seen in the last year or two during the pandemic?
Absolutely. And I think we're seeing it not just in the spike in violence, but across all these human service systems. For example, if you look at the census at the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, which has been in the news quite a bit lately, you'll see that, and I should say, during the budget impasse, services provided through the Department of Children and Family Services, because they were under a federal consent decree, so they were protected by a court order, and those funds were never impeded. But what was impeded was the things outside of child welfare that keep families safe and keep communities, you know, families together and keep communities safe. And we have seen since the budget impasse, a census increase in DCFS that has never reversed. It's still going up. And, you know, at one point we had less than, you know, about 15,000 kids in care. Now it's well over, I think it's over almost 22,000, you know, so we've seen this huge leap up. And again, the ripple effects of this trauma, when you take, you know, you're breaking up families, you're taking children away from their parents, even if they're not in great circumstances, there's still a trauma there. And, you know, so we're seeing this ripple effect all around, because it's not like the programs that were ended are just like light switches where you can turn them right back on again, right? You know, I know of an organization, Chicago Commons, that had a great after-school program, for example, in the back of the yards area, I think it was, and where they had 100% high school graduation rate for the kids in their after-school program. And during the budget impasse, they shut that program down and they've never started it again, you know? So it's not there, it's gone. And so it's you know, it's not like you can just wave a magic wand or turn on a light switch or something and think, oh, these resources are back on because the funding is there. There's a time that it takes. And of course, you know, when Governor Pritzker came into office, his first half of the year of his term, he was living with the last Bruce Rauner budget. Then they passed his budget, and halfway through that year, we began the pandemic, and that's had its own effects on, you know, like we've never really had a chance to recover fully, I think, from the budget impasse, and now we're dealing with the effects of this pandemic, and a lot of untreated trauma and a sort of really weakened human services infrastructure. So there's a lot going on out there.
Absolutely. Marianne Mason, we only have about 30 seconds left in our conversation. What do you hope policymakers take away from this work?
I hope that they begin to use state spending to support youth in their families as one of the tools in their tool set for reducing violence. I hope that there's a consciousness about being mindful and purposeful about that spending and what it could accomplish.
All right. Marianne Mason is Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at the Feinberg School of Medicine at Northwestern University. Andrea Durbin is the CEO of the Illinois Collaboration on Youth. I want to thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for our show today. Before we go, I do want to urge you to join our texting group. We hear interesting things from listeners. We ask you questions. We ask you to help set the course of our coverage. You can join by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Scholar. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.